Stripe helps many of the world's most influential companies grow their revenue and build a more profitable business. Whether it's Hertz making checkout a smooth ride for their customers, OpenAI answering unprecedented demand, or PGA chipping away at back office inefficiency, Stripe's financial infrastructure platform helps companies achieve ambitious goals. No matter what success looks like for your business, Stripe helps ensure the complexity of financial systems doesn't get in your way. Learn more at stripe.com.
Welcome back to Listen to Your Heart. I'm Jerry.
And I'm Jerry's Heart.
Today's topic, Repatha, Evolokimab. Heart, why'd you pick this one?
Well, Jerry, for people who have had a heart attack, like us, diet and exercise might not be enough to lower the risk of another one.
Okay.
To help know if we're at risk, we should be getting our LDL-C, our bad cholesterol, checked, and talking to our doctor.
I'm listening.
And if it's still too high, Repatha can be added to a statin to lower our LDL-C and our heart attack risk.
Guess it's time to ask about Repatha.
Do not take Repatha if you're allergic to it. Serious allergic reactions can occur. Get medical help right away if you have trouble breathing or swallowing, swelling of the face, lips, tongue, throat, or arms. Common side effects include runny nose, sore throat, common cold symptoms, flu or flu-like symptoms, back pain, high blood sugar, and redness, pain, or bruising at the injection site.
Listen to your heart.
Ask your doctor about Repatha. Learn more at Repatha.com or call 1-844-REPATHA.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Thanks to Vodafone Business. With cybersecurity solutions from Vodafone, your business can hack off the hackers. See vodafone.ie/business.
This is News Talk.
Yeah, you're very welcome along. Coming up over the next hour, we'll take a closer look at the curious case of the AI radio presenter who went on air undisclosed for months. Sticking with media, Glenn Mulcahy of Mojo Fest will talk about how technology is continuing to disrupt the industry. And as ever, I'll answer your tech questions. If you want to get in touch, you can do so right now. Drop me an email to techtalk@newstalk.com or you'll find me on Instagram at JessKellyNT. We'll also examine the EU fines issued to both Apple and Meta. But I want to start this week just talking briefly about Intel. You will have heard, I'm sure, that job cuts are being proposed and planned according to reporting from Bloomberg. The figure that we'd heard during the week is around 20% of its workforce. The company has around 108,000 employees around the world, with just under 5,000 people working at the Leixlip plant in Kildare. Now, Intel has said it could be July before the finalised headcount reduction is confirmed. And I think it goes without saying that it's a very anxious time for the employees and their families and indeed the whole community, particularly around the Leixlip region. We do know that Minister for Enterprise Peter Burke is continuing to engage with Intel, as is IDA Ireland. In a memo to staff, the CEO of Intel has said the company needs to go back to its roots, empowering engineers and removing organisational complexity. From his memo, he said that there's no way around the fact that these critical changes will reduce the size of our workforce. As I said when I joined, we need to make some very hard decisions to put our company on solid footing for the future. This will begin in Q2 and we will move as quickly as possible over the next several months. He's also said that those working on sort of the hybrid model will be required to return to the office 4 days a week. Up until this point, it had been 3 days a week. But I guess that requirement just adds to the uncertainty and the turbulence that I'm sure all employees around the world at Intel are feeling. But we will obviously continue to watch what happens at Intel and bring you updates as we get them. Elsewhere this week, as I mentioned a second ago, there were those big fines handed down to Apple and Meta. We're going to delve a little bit deeper into that in just a few minutes' time. But I want to start this week with Mojo Fest. This is an event taking place in the O'Reilly Hall in UCD on the 28th and 29th of April. So it's coming up next week. There is a brilliant lineup, including content creator Hannah Wilson, who's going to talk through using and maximizing the power of mobile content. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of talk about AI, and there'll be insights from CNN Academy. This entire event has been put together by Glenn Mulcahy, and I'm delighted to say that he joins me now. Glenn, how are you?
I'm great, Jess. Thanks a million. Are you?
Yeah, very well, thank you. And thanks a million for joining me. We spoke on this programme a few weeks ago about Radio Days, which took place in the Gibson Hotel, and it was a great event. And I had mentioned that I got to speak to yourself and a few others on a panel about AI in the radio industry. And before we kind of hit upon that, can you just tell me a little bit about your own experience and the setting up and the success of Mojo Fest to date?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I basically was involved in innovation in RTE in a former career, and I started an event that was the precursor to Mojo Fest back in 2015. And I did that mainly in response to the fact that I was a kind of a passionate advocate for using smartphones for storytelling, but kept hitting brick walls when it came to kind of technical standards and engineering standards and things like that. And I realized that there was a network of other people out there in other broadcasters doing very similar things, and kind of felt, well, we should try and facilitate a place for everyone to get together and share their experiences, including the mistakes that they've made, to try and make it so that we all don't repeat exactly the same mistakes. And that was the birth of RTE Mojocon in 2015. 10 years later, I left RTE nearly 9 years ago now, but 10 years later, we're back in Dublin, but so much has changed in the space. Mm-hmm. I had, to be honest with you, thought back in 2022 after I did the last event in London that I was kind of done. I kind of felt I'd achieved most of what I set out to do in 2015. But then, well, as you mentioned, AI. Mm-hmm. And obviously, there's a lot of changes happening in the broadcast space. The growth of social media, obviously, has really started to displace audiences. So I think it's a pretty opportune time to get back around the table and catch up and see where things are going.
Yeah, a lot of my own colleagues have been through training sessions with you, understanding the power of the mobile phone. When myself and John Riley are talking and reviewing phones on this show, I often say that my mobile phone is my office, because I can record interviews on it. I can record, you know, video content. I can send emails. I can file copy. It really is the all-encompassing tool, but it's not as straightforward as some people might think. Can you just take us on that little bit of a journey that you went through back in 2015 to convince people that, you know, it is sufficient to file, whether it is a report for the 6-1 on RTE or doing interviews on News Talk and so on?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. Fundamentally, I would say this is true of every tool on the planet. The tool is only as good as the person who is using it. So at the end of the day, the devices are, as you rightly say, they're incredibly powerful. But for the vast majority of people, they probably only use them to 10 or 15% of their true potential. And I would genuinely say, hand on heart, going all the way back to 2011, when I started researching mobile in a professional context, I have basically spent the best part of 15 years trying to convince people that it is good enough. I would argue now it has surpassed being good enough. So way back 2011 up to 2015, when I started training people and different broadcasters, there was already an ecosystem of pretty powerful apps for audio, for photography, for video, and for editing. But those have come such a long way in the decades since. I mean, I think these days when I run training courses like the ones you mentioned, that's still my bread and butter gig. And people are blown away when you show them some of the capabilities, because if you're not exposed to it, for the most part, you're probably oblivious, and that's completely understandable. But as you say, it is the office in your pocket, it's the studio in your pocket. Like, if you know what you're doing, it really is an insanely powerful tool. And it does tickle me somewhat. I was at an event in Vegas, I know one you've been to quite a lot actually, Jess, NAB, last year. And I did a session showing how you can use smartphones to set up a multi-camera studio, like 4 phones to create a live web TV show. And someone in the audience went, "You got to be kidding me." And I went, "Oh God, I feel like a broken record. I've been saying this for 15 years and people are still bewildered and bemused when you show them what it's capable of." So it is incredibly powerful. But like I say, the power is only unleashed once you have the knowledge.
Yeah. And one thing that I always think back to was the terror attack in Paris a number of years ago. We came in, it happened, I think it was November 13th. We came in to the office very late that night to put on a live show. And one of the big sources for us that day was Twitter. And we were looking at footage that citizens were putting up online of what was happening in real time. Now, obviously, you had to verify that it was legitimate and all the rest. But there have been those seminal moments in sort of geopolitics that have put the citizen journalist and the content that's coming from a live event to the fore. And that really did change the game in terms of leveling the playing field. It didn't have to be, you know, 4K quality content to make it to air or to be of value, particularly in a breaking news context.
100%. And actually, it's interesting that you would touch on that as a theme, because that is one of the sessions of the conference this year about the future of news. Because I personally have been observing this again, being a trainer, traveling internationally with some of the big news brands, you pick up on the trends and the discussions that are happening around the world and where people see news going. For me, and this goes back to the panel on AI that we had at Radio Days recently, for me, there's a big pivot happening in news, which is it's fueled by two different things. One is disenfranchisement, a big word, with the audience. We've seen news avoidance growing and growing over the last few years in the Reuters Digital News Report. It's at around 50% now, partly because people feel overwhelmed, partly because people are distrusting of big established news brands. And at the same time, blindsiding us in some ways is the rise of almost impossible to detect AI content. So these, I think, are two factors that are imminently about to clash and will rock traditional journalism, mainstream journalism, right to the core. And I think what we see, and there's a very strong trend leaning this way, is this idea of increasing the value of the human connection, which what I mean by that is, rather than necessarily as we used to traditionally trust big brands, I think people are going to lean into more trusting the individual reporter, because you can form a direct connection with them through their social channels. It's not just a hose pipe pushing content at you. There's the ability to communicate, to challenge, to have the person justify what they're saying. So it's completely interactive. And I think trust down to the human user, and I think mobile is going to be pivotal to this, is where we're going to see a pivot in news in the next 2 to 3 years. It will be very much about what I call own brand journalism, the individual becoming a storyteller, a point of trust where people will turn when they see so much stuff that they just simply cannot verify or take as the verbatim truth.
Yeah, I wrote about this for the Business Post a few months ago, because I was struck in the aftermath of the murder of Gabby Petito in the US. There was a huge search party trying to find where her body was, trying to find who had either abducted her or murdered her or whatever it was. And the amount of young American content creators on TikTok essentially giving daily news caps and then also turning into, you know, Inspector Morse trying to solve the case. It is unnerving as someone who works in the media sector to see that trend, that movement to individuals who have no real training, no sort of defamation training, none of the legal stuff that we all have to go through, but they do have the technical skills, and suddenly they have a megaphone that gives them equal footing, if not larger, particularly with younger audiences.
You're absolutely right. I mean, the rise of the influencer in news is, again, a topic that we want to grapple with this year, because, again, we're seeing statistics from the Reuters News Report saying that Gen Z, up to 52% of them, first point of contact for news is with influencers, not traditional qualified journalists. And there is a massive risk with that, because if you look, and you know, many of my friends are influencers, work within the creator economy, so I'm not being in any way disparaging of them. But the bottom line is that if you're an influencer, at the end of the day, the way that you really make your money is brand deals. You're not going to, unless you have a huge following, you're not going to make it just from eyeballs alone. So the bottom line is that if it is a commercial activity, and if you're doing activity basically just simply to garner eyeballs, then there's a real risk that you can, you know, you can be influenced. And I don't mean, you know, with your audience. I mean, people can approach you to say, we want you to endorse this product or endorse this particular policy line or whatever. And there is a move towards this. You can see this in some countries around the world where there is an aggregation of influencers who are basically being brought together and used or leveraged, if you want to call it, as like an influencer army to champion particular talking points en masse to a very, very big social audience. So again, and I would reiterate exactly what you said, there's a fundamental difference between what has for the last decade been referred to as a citizen reporter, where anyone can pick up their phone and live stream or shoot a video, and the actual qualification that defines journalism. It is the ethics, it is the legal framework, it is understanding bias, it is understanding how to approach the story so that you're giving both sides and you know, for the best part as a human, trying impartiality. They're not the same thing. I've been saying this for a long time. I've been berated for saying it, but they're not the same thing. So I do draw a line between citizen reporters. I think they have a place. I think, as you said, in the case in Paris and in other cases, you can use social media to basically aggregate those live feeds and to create a narrative because you're not on the ground there yourself. But in that scenario, the authenticity and being able to verify who the subject is that you're taking the content from is absolutely pivotal. The problem is, as AI really starts to get so much better, we see the rise of completely fabricated content being shared as well. There was a piece, I can't remember, was the earthquake quite recently? There was a piece that was completely fabricated and went viral, of course, and it was AI generated. There was a lot of talk about it. So again, reiterating this idea that the real value is the human connection between the journalist and their followers. I mean, I came so close to managing to get Taylor Lorenz, who is a substantive tech influencer in the US, to come over for the conference. And her case study, because I was at an event earlier this week, she spoke about moving into being a freelance independent journalist, having worked in the New York Times and other big, big established brands. And I mean, her business case alone was food for thought. She used a Substack to share her content. She is a qualified journalist. People, I think she said 60,000 people subscribe to her service on Substack as paying subscribers because they trust her. And as a result of that, she is now making a very successful independent career as a solo journalist. And I can see that happening a lot more.
We need to delve a little bit deeper now into that AI point. We've spoken obviously about AI a lot on this program. And one of the big issues that I have at the moment with AI and generative AI is that if you ask it to tell you about a certain event, so say if it is the Paris attack or whatever it may be, not only can it hallucinate, but it can also cite sources that have been written by AI. And so I do feel that the layer of digging that the journalist using it or the individual using some platform, they do have to check and verify every single element that a Gen AI produces at this stage. I'm sure it'll get better. But would you have concerns around that as well, that this, it's kind of this endless feedback loop of AI Gen content now?
100%. I mean, actually, this is where I think that government, aside from regulation discussions, we'll park that one for now. I think government can take a leadership role in this. We've seen in a couple of countries the concept of pre-bunking, which is raising public awareness about the actual problems with AI and flagging things to look for so that you don't fall into the trap of being disinformed. And I'm not saying it's necessarily with malicious intent. It's just exactly as you say, the way the algorithms learn, they can basically do their own reinforcement and create a feedback loop that makes it hallucinate and basically deliver false information. We've seen this with legal cases. There's been quite a few instances where people have actually realized a little too late that the information that they took verbatim from particularly ChatGPT as an example was in fact entirely fabricated, in spite of the fact that it vehemently defended it and claimed it was true. So yeah, there's a cautionary tale to be learned in there. And sure, maybe the next iteration of ChatGPT will be, you know, incrementally better and so on. But at the end of the day, what is not visible to people when they use a lot of AI is the information that that AI was trained on. So you have no real understanding of the source material that it's being trained or that it's taken its learning from. And as a result of that, you have to apply a due diligence and a degree of caution to anything that you feel on it. And I think that behaviorally is something that we all probably need to get very comfortable with going forward.
Yeah. Now, later in the show, we're going to talk about a case from this week that caught my eye of an AI voice being broadcast on Australian radio for months without being disclosed. That's the scary side of it. Can we talk about some of the good uses for AI in the media sector?
Yeah, I mean, there's no question. I may sound like a staunch cynic, but I am not. I will be perfectly honest with you. I'll tie this back to MojoFest as an example. I have used AI extensively with marketing pipelines for the event this year, trying to kind of take what has been traditionally a fairly laborious graft and basically see if I can automate it and improve the speed and efficiency. And there are tons of opportunities for doing that. I think the fundamental differentiator is This is ways, if you like, behind the scenes of improving your efficiencies, but without undermining the editorial credibility that is, you know, basically part of both of our jobs. So there definitely are some incredible tools. I mean, I was on a course only a few days ago. We don't mind me mentioning a specific one, but there were people speaking about a service called Opus Clip, which will take a longer form video and use AI and machine learning to allow you to basically auto render short social viral clips from that longer form content. It will do that entire process for you. It analyzes what's being said. It actually looks at the video content and it chops it up and reverses it into vertical short bites of content. I mean, as that improves, and of course, the thing to remember is the more it does it, the more material is fed through it, the better it gets. As that improves, that's the sort of stuff where a lot of small publishers really struggle. You know, they deploy people, they may have limited resources, they do a story, but then having to generate 4, 5, or even 6 different iterations of that is bloody time consuming. Mm-hmm. If you have a trustworthy AI where, you know, after iteration, you realize that its accuracy is very good. And of course, you can always modify it. So never click the button and then auto-publish. You need to have that point of intervention and check. But it will definitely streamline that process and make people much more efficient. And hopefully in doing so, help to feed into the idea of there is no one audience. Your audience is actually very disparate across different platforms, different profiles. So being able to reach all those different audiences in the specific tone and format that is that specific niche. That's where AI really comes in. And then there's the whole world of, you know, automated subtitling, reversioning, which YouTube has just started to roll out. You put up a vlog in English and you can now generate multiple different languages of it using AI where it reanimates the face and stuff. I mean, there is a line forming that is, it begs the question, just because we can doesn't necessarily mean we should. And that's something that, again, is going to be one of the points of discourse in MojoFest this year, because we have some really quite provocative examples that I think will challenge people's perceptions of what's ethically correct with AI.
Yeah, and I think that ethical side of the conversation is something that's been spinning around in my brain over the last little while, because radio, I do think, is, and podcasts are the same, it's a beautifully intimate medium where you are connecting and you're building that relationship. And I suppose I'm just curious about, as more and more AI tools come into the industry and definitely do save us time and money and all that good stuff, at what point is the authenticity of the connection going to be eroded? And will the listener notice? Will they care? Will there be detrimental losses that we won't necessarily notice at the time, but when we look back in 15 years, we'll be like, oh yeah, that's the pinpoint moment of when things changed.
Well, I think the case that you cited there a second ago is a really interesting example of this. So there have been cases, for instance, in South Korea, where there is a television news service that uses an AI-generated avatar to read the news bulletin every night. And I remember when I learned about it first, I thought, oh my God, like, where are we headed? You know, there's an entire role eliminated from the newsroom. There's someone who's never going to have to go front of camera again. The case of the presenter on radio in Australia, where I think it was 6 months, wasn't it, that it basically ran, and it was a whistleblower that highlighted the fact that, in fact, they had sampled, like, someone from the kind of clerical side of the organization. They'd sampled her voice and then created this new AI persona that basically was the presenter on air every night for 6 months. And basically the line was, well, you know, the audience didn't even notice. So why should we say that it's AI generated? I think that fundamentally is dangerous, because you could pretty quickly, in a station which is predominantly commercial leaning, realize that, hang on a second, you deploy 8 of those personas and now you just have an AI radio station. There's no staff running it anymore. It just basically cues tracks the way that Spotify does. Is that what people want? You know, I think one of the real value points, I actually said this at Radio Days, one of the real value points for radio is the sense of service to community, which when you start to get into the AI territory, I think is something that could be lost. And so I think that idea of the local voice is, again, it's the thing that's going to become even more valuable as we start to see more and more automation on air. And the one thing, Jess, I don't know if you agree with this, but the one thing from my perspective is, in a lot of the organizations I'm in right now, where they're trying to kind of consolidate a policy statement on the deployment of AI, there's a huge amount of navel gazing. But respectfully, most of it is just taking a shot in the dark and hoping for the best until we actually start to see what the feedback from polls with the audience's response and everything is like. We really don't know whether people will be accepting or whether they will recoil against it. We simply don't know. So I think it's a case of a degree of caution is probably a very sensible approach for the next little while.
Yeah, absolutely. And it kind of reminds me back when social media started. I started a News Talk when I was 19, and I remember saying at the time, you know, we should be on Twitter. And I remember people looking at me like I was mad because it wasn't a big thing. It wasn't the news source that it developed into. And it was seen as this kind of gimmick. And we tested it and we trialed it. And eventually, a few years later, we had a social media policy. And I sometimes feel like technology comes and there's always going to be sort of early adopters who see the potential and who want to get involved. But when the decision makers don't necessarily fully understand the technology and haven't used it themselves, it's very difficult to have meaningful policies in place to protect the business, the staff, and then also the consumer. So it doesn't matter if you're working in manufacturing or in radio, you still have consumers out there who are engaging with your product. But I do think education is the answer here. And whether you are the CEO, the CFO, or the intern, you all need to get your hands on and figure out where it works, where it doesn't, and what the potential pitfalls are.
100%. And actually, in many ways, to be perfectly honest, going back to the origin story of MojoFest with AI, that's exactly why we need to have these periodic roundtables where we kind of openly say, here's what we're doing. Here's what we've learned and we're willing to share for the greater good of everyone in this particular industry. I mean, it was one of the kind of takeaways from Radio Days, wasn't it? This idea that everyone doing it in isolation is not a great strategy because it puts so much pressure on smaller broadcasters. If we can form a kind of a steering group, which in many ways was the birth of MojoCon when it started as well, we can all learn from each other. And it is a kind of a movement for the greater good, so to speak. And we can all learn from each other's mistakes and what we take away as well. So I think same thing. I think it, not just isolating specifically to radio, but I think across multiple industries, I think going alone on it with this sense of, oh, if I share what we're doing, someone might steal the idea. I think that's a very, very inward looking approach. And I don't think that's necessarily the best strategy. Honestly, I think getting around the table, having discourse around, you know, your fears, what you've trialed, what has worked and what has not worked, and what are your takeaways, is hugely valuable. And in many ways, that is in essence what we're trying to do at MojoFest, to give that platform to people come and share what they've learned.
Yeah, brilliant stuff. Well, I'm going to be there. It's taking place, as I said, on the 28th and 29th in UCD, the O'Reilly Hall. The website, if you want more information, is mojofest.eu. Glenn, thank you so much for joining me here on News Talk.
Absolute pleasure chatting to you, Jess. Thanks so much.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Welcome back to Tech Talk. This is Nova in for Jess Kelly. Before the break, Glenn from MojoFest told us about the disruptive nature of technology in the media sector. And we want to stick with that theme now. Take a listen to this news report from Nine News Australia.
Workdays with Thigh. It sounds like the name of a regular radio show, but all is not as it seems. It's now been revealed Thigh is not a real person. Instead, Australia's first AI radio announcer, broadcasting 4 hours a day on a Sydney station, CADA.
The revelation has sparked criticism of radio giant ARN, which owns the broadcaster CADA. Tech expert Stephen French joins us now. Stephen, this is both extraordinary, it is also concerning. Can you tell us exactly what is happening here? How is this playing out?
Yeah, good morning. This is a great example of the generative AI that's possible now. In this case, it's audio, but we've seen, of course, you can produce pictures and videos, and you've seen the deep fake videos that have been produced, which are even imitating people, politicians and other celebrities. So it's the technology's gotten to a point now where it's actually very hard to distinguish between what's AI and what's real.
Stephen, Thigh's been on air for months now. Why are we only just learning about this?
Well, I think it's on ARN, I think, to be a bit more transparent about that whole thing.
That report from Nine News Australia detailing how an AI-generated presenter managed to host a radio show for months without anyone knowing. I, myself, am an AI-generated voice. Would you know, and would it bother you? I would love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, techtalk@newstalk.com. I'll hand back to Jess for now.
Thanks, Nova. How mildly sinister. That, just for full disclosure, is an AI voice that I created on a free platform online in less than 3 minutes. The website has an array of voices that I can select. You can alter the tone, the pitch, and the speed of the voice. And then I obviously fed in that script. So the voice in question was called Nova. And I downloaded it in a matter of minutes, which is freaky deaky. But
The wider point here is that clip from Nine News Australia that focuses on a radio station that broadcast an AI voice for months without disclosing it. Now, I don't know, like, obviously I work in this industry, so I am incredibly invested in stuff like this, not only from a personal point of view, but also an industry shift point of view. So the station in question, so it's the ARN, which is the Australian Radio Network, is the media company behind a whole host of different stations. And their presenter, the fake presenter, was called Thai. And it reportedly used the voice of someone from the finance department of that company to broadcast from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. on weekdays. That's a lot of airtime at a peak part of the day when loads of people will be listening. It was also promoted as any radio show would be. Here's a bit of the blurb that was posted about the show. It says, Thai will be playing you the hottest tracks from around the world. Curated by our music experts, these are the songs that are charting or on the cusp of blowing up. Hear it first with Thai so you can boast to your friends and say you were all over it first. Cool. I think the biggest issue here is the undisclosed nature of it. Because there's no denying that the technology is cool. And like, would you have known that the little voice that I created there for free was a fake voice? I would argue that yes, you would, because it sounded a little bit robotic. And as someone who works with audio, I could tell a million miles away it was fake. But I think the notion of kind of duping people into believing they were listening to a person and a person's personality for it only to be an AI generated thing is a big issue. So the ARN group, so the Australian Radio Network, did issue a statement. They said, we've been trialling AI audio tools on CADA using the voice of Thai, an ARN team member. This is a space being explored by broadcasters globally. And while the trial has offered valuable insights, it's also reinforced the unique value that personalities bring to creating truly compelling content. Like, yeah, obviously, radio stations and broadcasters and content creators around the world are looking to AI to see how, where, when, and why the technology could be used. But that whole thing of duping listeners into thinking they're listening to an authentic voice, it's just not okay. And whilst doing it as a trial is fair enough, I think it could have been done in a more ethical way, perhaps. Maybe there should have been a disclaimer at some point along the way. Also, running it for that, like, it ran for months. Every weekday from 11 to 3 for months. I really don't like it. And I do think, and this is where I get kind of high and mighty about my beloved radio, but I do think the beauty of radio is the connection that the person sitting in my seat has to the person sitting in your seat, or maybe you're standing, I don't know. But it is, it's the, like, you're always talking to one person. So right now I am talking to you. I'm not talking to thousands of people. I'm literally, it's me talking to you. And if you're on the receiving end of what I'm saying, you can think I'm a dose, you can enjoy the show, you can ignore me, whatever it is, but it's two humans interacting. Whereas if you're on the receiving end and you're enjoying listening to music to tell your friends that you knew of it before anyone else did, and the person bringing it to you is not actually a person, and you're listening to links, so the bits of talking in between the songs that are being delivered by an AI without knowing it's an AI, I just think it's a really, really uncomfortable space to be in. But I'd love to know your thoughts. Firstly, would you have known that Nova, the voice at the top, was fake? Would it bother you listening to an AI versus a human? You can email me techtalk@newstalk.com. And you see, the difference here is when I give you that email address, I, a human being, read them. I don't have a show. I don't have a team working on this show. So if an email comes in and if it's read out on the show or if you receive a reply, that's from me, a human being. Would you rather sending in messages and it being fed into an AI that can regurgitate it? We can do that on the show. Maybe next week I'll see how AI answers your tech questions. But yeah, I just think it's a sort of morally murky area, would be my view. But yeah, let me know what you think. TechTalk@newstalk.com. Now on to something completely different. A new documentary came to Disney Plus on Friday of this week. It's called Flintoff, and it follows the incredible experience that Andrew Flintoff, known as Freddie Flintoff, had while filming for Top Gear. You might be aware that he was in a life-altering crash in 2022, and this documentary follows him and his family as he works to pick up the pieces. This is the trailer.
I remember everything about it.
Freddie Flintoff has been in a crash.
It's so vivid.
These injuries are life-altering.
This is what I'm left with. I've lived under the radar for 7 months. One of the real frustrations was the speculation. That's why I'm doing this now. What actually happened?
Should I call you Freddie or Andrew?
I was this shy kid growing up. They started calling me Fred. And then I found this alter ego.
One half was a solid man, and the other half was a child.
No one had as much talent as Freddie.
He was incredible.
He gave us these images, which are ingrained in our sporting psyche.
There was just something about him that was different. As soon as someone says that's impossible, then that makes him fly. All of a sudden, your life can change like that.
It's almost like a reset. I'm trying to find out what I am now. I've always seemed to be able to flick a switch. I've got to find that switch again.
Yeah, that is a trailer for Flintoff, which has arrived to Disney Plus. I have been a fan of Freddie Flintoff's for quite a while. I used to watch him on, oh, what's that TV show on Sky? A League of Their Own. He was a team captain on A League of Their Own. And I just, he was funny, he was bold, he was a bit of crack. And obviously then when he moved to Top Gear, it was great. That's a show that I used to watch all the time with my dad. And it was brilliant to see sort of a new life being breathed into that show. But obviously it has been off the air since that crash. And what I've been thinking about since first hearing that this documentary was coming is, it's brilliant that there is a follow-on to stories that dominate news headlines for quite a while. So when that crash happened, obviously enough, it was front page news. There was a lot of talk, a lot of controversy around how the BBC handled it. But I do think it's brilliant that there is this follow-on now with these types of documentaries. So as I said, Flintoff is now available on Disney Plus. As ever, if you have any recommendations for me, please do send them my way. I am on the hunt for TV shows, movies, books, as always. You can drop me an email to techtalk@newstalk.com. I was off for a few days at the beginning of the week, and I ended up rewatching elements of Grey's Anatomy. I don't know why I do it to myself. But if you have any good recommendations that aren't Grey's Anatomy, techtalk@newstalk.com is the email. And speaking of the email, when we come back here on News Talk, I'll answer your tech questions.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Welcome back to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Coming up in just a few minutes' time, John Fardy will be in with Screen Time. But before we get to John, earlier in the week, the European Union slapped Apple and Meta with a combined fine of €700 million for breaching the Digital Markets Act. This is the first time the EU has issued fines under the new regulation, which is looking to curb the power of big tech companies. Now, you may be wondering, what exactly did Apple and Meta do? Well, Apple received a €500 million fine for restricting how app developers communicate with users about alternative sales and offers. Essentially, Apple was making it difficult for developers to inform customers about cheaper options outside of the App Store. So that's that one. Meta, on the other hand, was fined €200 million for its controversial pay or consent advertising model. You may remember we spoke about this before. This model was pushing users in the EU to either pay for ad-free access to Facebook and Instagram or consent to targeted advertising. The EU found that this model infringed upon a user's right to freely consent to use their personal data. Both companies, this is not a shock, have criticised the EU's decision. Apple claims that the block is unfairly targeting them and compromising their products' privacy and security. And Meta argues that the fines are an attempt to handicap successful American businesses while allowing Chinese and European companies to operate under different standards. Despite the backlash, the European Commission is standing by its decision entirely. They believe the fines are necessary to ensure fair competition and to protect consumers in the digital market. Now, a few things here. I was struck by the language that Meta used in the aftermath of this decision. That whole thing of, you know, the fines are an attempt to handicap successful American businesses. I saw another statement somewhere that equated these fines to tariffs, which is obviously a bit of a buzz term at the moment. So things are definitely becoming even more politicised, if that was possible. I also want to bring you, I saw Anne O'Leary, who is the head of Meta Ireland. She shared a post on her LinkedIn on the day the fines were announced. I'm going to read it to you in its entirety because I just think, again, the language here is quite interesting. So she wrote, "Today, the EU Commission decided to fine Meta and demand product changes that fundamentally alter our business model, which is based on personalised advertising, the foundation of the free internet. This decision, which we will likely appeal, has the potential to significantly hurt European businesses who continue to use our personalised ad tools in large numbers to find new customers, expand into new markets and compete with larger companies. European businesses can earn 107 billion euro annually from personalised ads on our platforms. Each 1 euro spent on Meta ads yields 3.79 euro in advertiser revenues across Europe. These are big numbers and small businesses, which make up over 99% of businesses in the EU and employ over 100 million people across the region, are likely to be particularly hard hit. The timing of this could not be worse for European firms. At a time when innovation and growth should be the focus, this decision signals that the EU is closed for business." Now, there's a few reasons why I wanted to read that in full. Firstly, because I think if I'd picked one or two sentences, it wouldn't give you the comprehensive overview. I also think it is interesting to see the stats that Meta offer in terms of the impact of its advertising. But it's that final paragraph to me that sticks out. So I'll read it again. "The timing of this could not be worse for European firms. At a time when innovation and growth should be the focus, this decision signals that the EU is closed for business." My read on that is that fines and regulation means Europe is not a good place for American firms in particular to do business. We know that here in Ireland, we play host to a whole number of big tech firms. We're their headquarters. And if that's the attitude and the outlook of these companies, that is really concerning. I do think we're going to get to a stage where, and this is not in relation to Meta, but in terms of big tech in general in Europe, we are going to get to the stage where they are playing poker with each other. And it's going to be a case of who blinks first. I think the conversations around tariffs and President Trump's approach to the EU in particular is going to cause a lot of headaches down the line. And I'm very interested to see, firstly, if Meta does appeal and indeed if Apple appeals, but also what comes of it and just how far this sort of tit for tat thing is going to go. We will, of course, bring you updates as and when they happen. But yeah, I just thought it was a pretty interesting statement from the head of Meta in Ireland. Right, before I let you go, we're going to jump into the inbox and answer some of your questions. First up, we have an email here that says, "Hi, Jess, I'm looking for a new mid-range phone. I want something with a great camera and long battery life. Most importantly, though, I don't want to break the bank. Ideally, less than 700 euro. Any recommendations?" Yeah, like as John Riley and I were talking about on the program a few weeks ago, firstly, it's nearly impossible to buy a bad smartphone. And secondly, you can get an awful lot for between 500 and 700 euro. So I've actually been testing out the new Samsung A56 over the last few days. And this is a gorgeous premium looking phone that ticks every single one of your spec boxes there in your email. And what's great about it is that it's 560 euro. I've been really impressed by it during my review period. I'll have a full review on Tuesday's Pat Kenny show. But if you are out and about looking to buy today or tomorrow, try and get your hands on it. It is the Samsung A56. Next up, I have an email here from Gav in Fairview. He says, "Hey Jess, my partner and I have just gone sale agreed on our first home." Oh, congratulations. She's taking care of the paint, but I'm taking care of the smart home side of things. I heard you mention before that you are a Google house, wondering if you could share why that is and any recommendations of what to buy and what to avoid. This could be my TED talk. I have done so much research into pretty much everything that we've done with our home. I'm actually going to do, myself and Derek Riley, we're talking about it. We're going to do a housey special tech talk in a few weeks' time. But we are a Google house. The reason being that myself and my partner, we both use Google everything. We both use Google phones. We both use Gmail. Google is kind of the center of everything for us. We have the Google Stream, which is the new version of the Chromecast. So we already had a lot of Google involved in our lives. The only Amazon thing that we had was an Amazon Prime account. So it just made sense from that point of view. And I am so glad that we have gone down the Google route because I love all of the hardware. So we have the Google doorbell. We got the wireless version, which is great because the setup is simply drilling the bracket into the side of the door and then mounting the doorbell on it. You do have to charge it. We get around 5 or 6 weeks out of the doorbell and then you charge it for, I think it's 3 or 4 hours. But I love the Google Home app. I can tap in, I can see who's at the front door, I can talk to them, I can change the parameters that the camera picks up. It's really, really useful. Next up, we don't have a chime for the doorbell. So what we do have are a few of the Google Nest, the smart assistants placed around the place. So all of those I would highly recommend. The next thing I would say, and this might be controversial, is definitely get smart light bulbs, right? But watch where you're buying them because the price there's a huge price difference between very well-known brand ones and not so well-known brand ones. I have bought, I think, 12 of the not so well-known brand ones. I got them in deals. And I have them in the kitchen and in the bedrooms. And although they're not big name brands, they do have the Google and the Amazon Alexa symbol on the front. So I knew that they would work. The only difference that I've encountered is that you have to download sort of their own app first. Then you can incorporate into your Google Home. It's a little bit finickety, but it saved me a lot of money and it does the exact same thing. So smart bulbs, absolutely go for it. The other big point that I would flag is once you get your keys, and this isn't to do with smart homes. This is just to do with the day-to-day functioning of your home. Once you get your keys, check where your modem, your modem is in the house and check where your signal reaches and does not reach in the house. In my house, it's very frustrating. When I go upstairs, I lose signal. So we are finally going to get a Tendinova mesh system. We're going to buy it and install it to try and get rid of those black spots. But I would say before you go out and spend a cent on any smart home equipment, check your speed first of all, check the placement of your modem and make sure that you have it in the optimized space. There's no point in having all this Notions tech if your internet and your signal doesn't follow you around the house. I could talk about this 4 days, but we will do a tech talk special. So if you have any questions, this is a good one now. If you have any questions, particularly relating to technology for the home, it could be garden tech, it could be white goods, it could be a vacuum cleaner, whatever it is. If you have any specific questions, email me techtalk@newstalk.com and myself and Derek will do a housey special over the coming weeks. That is it from me this week. If you want to get in touch with me, you can do so techtalk@newstalk.com. Quick reminder that I am doing the VHI Women's Mini Marathon in aid of Dublin Rape Crisis Centre on the June Bank Holiday weekend. If you would like to donate, it would mean the world to me. You can head to idonate.ie/run4DRCC. Every single cent that we raise is going to the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre. Also, I'm going to run a raffle to try and raise funds for Dublin Rape Crisis Centre in the lead up to the marathon. So if you or your business would like to donate a prize, you can email me techtalk@newstalk.com and I would be incredibly grateful. Right, that's it. I'm out of here. Good luck and I will talk to you soon.